So I was reading the other day that it turns out they did a survey, and the people who program in NoSQL always eat lunch alone. Very, very sad thing to understand. And it turns out they don't know how to join tables. Danny Markham here with Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to Nerd Roundup before, every week we get together, we shoot the shit, talk about technical articles, what the nerds have been talking about. We just try to have fun. A team that can goof off together can do about damn near anything. And so, pony up to the lunch counter, let's talk some tech news. This week we have John Kern. I think Greg may join in a bit. Hey, John.
Good one on the NoSQL joke.
That comes from one of our listeners, Diego. He texted me that, telling he won the Nerdy Joke of the Week contest. I don't know, 100 internet points to Diego.
It's like a nerd dad joke, yeah. You can't join tables.
I was telling somebody on Twitter the other day that sometimes I tell puns so bad I feel I'll be punished in the afterlife. And it just makes me happy when I do that. So. Hey, Greg, because you're starting this clean shaven, you're looking different, dude.
I know. I probably look like I'm a junior developer now.
I know. What the hell happened?
We're going to have to get you in a tie, man.
Oh, dear.
So the first thing you usually do is what everybody's been doing. John, what you been up to the last week or two?
Well, as we were talking, toured the beautiful parts of New Mexico and Arizona. So we were with some friends from three kids that happened to have moved to Tucson, Arizona, decades ago. So we enjoyed Santa Fe and Taos and Monument Valley and the Upper Cantaloupe Canyon, Slot Canyon. So it's a beautiful time of year. Until we got to Phoenix and it was like 100 degrees, and that sucked. It had to have been an anomaly.
Hey, at least it's a dry heat.
It's a dry heat.
Yeah so is where you bake bread. Yeah, a pizza oven's dry too, but it's still hot as hell. And it was, luckily we went to the Desert Botanical Garden to see a Cholula glass sculptor type. So we were outside in the sun, and luckily they have drinking fountains all over the place. Cause there's my camera, you know, I see this message on it saying, we're going to switch some mode to some other mode because your camera is overheating.
Wow.
What?
Wow.
And my cell phone was hot as hell, and realized, oh, it's because it's a freaking sun and we're out in the middle of the desert and it's hot as blazes. But other than that, hopefully that was like the last day. But up till then, it was pretty gorgeous weather, you know, freezing in the morning, but then beautiful in the afternoons. And, you know, because we're usually at 6,000 or 7,000 feet, yes, or 5,000. So we enjoyed it. I can't say enough about it. It was really, we had like a Navajo guide, although they're actually known as Diné. Navajo is not there, what they call themselves. So I was like, oh, interesting.
I know that.
So yeah, it was good.
Well, that is an interesting one. I didn't know that one.
Yeah, I think the Spanish gave it to them. Somebody gave it to them and it stuck. But they really call themselves like D-I-N-D-N-E, like A with an E with an apostrophe maybe, or like dash E-A.
Given the pronunciation and spelling, Spanish sounds quite likely.
Hmm. Yeah.
I love the American Southwest. Beautiful. It's like America's backyard. Beautiful country.
Beautiful. This is spectacular.
Greg, what you been up to?
Beans.
What? You say bees?
Seeds.
No,
seeds. As in things like you plant.
Planting.
Yeah. Are you getting into farming now? Or?
No. I think I've mentioned it before with both of you guys that I've been fairly involved with things going on in Ukraine.
Yes.
And one of the things that kind of got presented to me was, well, we have these problems.
Seem to have lost Greg for a moment.
Yeah. bad soil, which were intended to. Well, that's what I've been working on. Many kilograms of seeds being put from big bags into little bags.
Oh, cool. Sounds like a good. Sounds like we used to say the Lord's work as I was growing up. That's a good thing. When you're doing the Lord's work, you're doing a good thing for other people. I have been. Can you guys hear me? Hey-o. Nope. Nope. Hey-ho. Oh.
Do you hear Dan, Greg?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Turns out the push-to-talk button only works if the application is highlighted, which is kind of defeats the whole purpose of doing push-to-talk button, but there it is. So Greg has been doing good deeds. That's a good thing.
Good deeds with seeds.
Good deeds with seeds. I have been writing some essays. I actually learned something very interesting yesterday. I learned that I developed what's called a alpha-gal syndrome. And I would think that it would be related to your wife not being tough enough, since it's called alpha-gal. But no, it's actually a tick bites you. And then you can't eat red meat. I'm not sure. I don't think it's going to be permanent. But ate some meatloaf for breakfast, turned beet red. But pulse went to about 130, blood pressure dropped through the floor. It was a lot of fun. Just I know it doesn't sound very much fun when I describe it like that, but...
I believe the answer to this is you need to eat it raw.
Yeah. The thing is, I ate beef hot dogs for lunch that day. It was fine. I don't know. They say it's a weird thing. They think ticks carry it, and some people would get it really bad, so they can't like even look at a hamburger. And some people just get it every 5 years. And so I think I must be the latter type. I've never had an allergic reaction to anything, so this is very exciting for me.
Well, since you do have it, I think it's time that you do some experimentation. So, as an example, do insects cause a reaction?
If you eat them.
So go get some grasshoppers, fry them up.
Oh, no.
And you're going to need to do two experiments on this one. You're going to need to try one with sunflower seed oil and another one in, let's say, lard.
Lard?
I've got a plan that's just like that, except for I go to the doctor and get an EpiPen, and I don't eat the insects. But other than that, it's exactly like what you're saying, Ray. So
you're not learning anything in your plan.
I'm learning I don't want to stop breathing, which I learned yesterday. And turns out that was a pretty good lesson for me.
Yeah. Our one daughter has a friend.
Ah. Isn't that something?
Yeah. This is also a really, really bizarre allergy to have, like when you have to go to a restaurant and tell them, by the way, I'm allergic to any milk product.
Yes, it's very hard. I don't think she goes out often. Weird like that.
Yeah, I think my mom discovered she was allergic to penicillin when she took some and it almost killed her. So it's sometimes you learn some hard lessons there, yes.
Be honest, a lot of people who have these allergies, the way that they found out that they have them is because they took them and almost died.
I know this feeling. Yes, I'm with you, bud. Yeah. I was making a whistling sound when I was breathing yesterday. It wasn't fun.
Yeah, you're restricting.
Yes, I would swallow spit and it would hurt because my throat was constricted. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, worst case, you have to like jab yourself in the neck.
Yeah. Give you, yeah, sure. Trick yourself. Yeah. So that was pretty exciting. So the first article we have this week is At the Boundaries, Applications Aren't Functional. And this guy wrote an essay 10 years ago that at the boundaries, applications are not object-oriented. And now he says, well, they're not functional either. And so it's got into this discussion of how do you think of the boundaries of whatever thing that you're writing? And that, to me, sounded pretty interesting. I don't really like his analysis very much, but you know, what is the outside?
I tried to contact Mark on this one.
Oh, cool.
And I have not heard back from yet, which is not that surprising, as it's currently, I believe, 8 o'clock his time.
Do you know Mark?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So what I want to discuss with him was, if we look at something like, let's say, an event source domain model, what if all that I did was, instead of saying repository.save, I returned the events from the command that you pushed in? Would that not actually reach being functional?
The thing is, the event stream's even neater because you've got this stream of stuff that, in theory, could have multiple consumers. So you, by returning the event, I'm not sure you did anything. As a caller, how do I know that the event stream is actually producing any results? I know from the outside... Yeah. Right? From the outside, look at the whole system, maybe there's some reporting or whatever, but as a caller, it's like, how do you, and Greg ran away. We've stumped the chump. We've got the first article in. But yeah, Greg and I were doing a little texting in the general room before we started, and this gets, to me at least, gets down to the point of, like, who's the guy, right? So Greg talks about the event stream. Well, is that the guy who sends the event? Is that the guy? You know, who's the human being who's writing code, and where do they think the outside of their system is? And it's a weird question, because you can think of it different ways. Like, for instance, just to play with this idea, let's say you wrote an app that runs off the command line and, I don't know, consumes something from a web page. Maybe it's this old-timey CGI app where the web page comes at it, runs a little app on the thing. Well, is that an object? You can certainly say that it has a structure. Maybe it's a class with a main method, and it takes, that's an object. Well, is it functional? Well, you know, there's this request that comes in and it returns. That's a function, in and out function. Is it procedural? Well, you know, the application works in a sequential basis no matter. So the answer is yes, it is. So how do you think about it? Greg, any thoughts on that?
Sorry, I just came back in.
I was just saying that, you know, you could take the same application, just say a CGI app, and you can say either it's OO, like a class, or you can say it's functional because I call something and the CGI it comes back, or you could say it's procedural because it code runs in strict order. So,
who's this happens with nearly all code the moment that we start interchanging the concept of message pass and method call.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a difference between I'm telling you something and I want you to do something. And the thing is that you have to get back to who the coder is, because different programmers in the same system can view those things. One person's a message and he's returning a message from a class. Another person, it's an event. Or, you know, it's an odd thing. It depends on, it's an analysis question, not really a code question.
Well, but the thing is that a method call and a message pass have been shown in many languages to be equivalent. A prime one we could look at? Erlang!
Yeah.
Yay, Erlang!
Yeah. And, you know, Alan Kay, I think a couple times has come back and said, dudes, I just wanted object-oriented to be message passing. Not all the stuff we built now, just message passing.
But
Right.
It makes a material difference in your code whether you pass a message or whether you call a method.
Yes.
But isn't calling a method a message?
Maybe.
That's the thing, yeah. It may or may not be. So I could send you an event, let's say event instead of message, send you an event with just 4K of stuff, blah, blah. And to you, it may mean something. It may not. Maybe you just take the blob and pass it to somebody else, in which case it's just data. But if you start throwing types around, if I'm saying I'm sending a customer record to you, well, then you start coupling up the actual message passing with actually wanting some function to do something.
Well, it gets even worse when you start looking at events. How about customer deactivated?
Yeah. And we're back to complex replicated data types. All roads lead to this.
Mostly for you.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, is that if you decouple calling a function, like we think of a message with an object, if you think of that differently than just messaging, which I do, well, then you've got to handle the case of what if you're waiting on multiple messages, you know, if I care about what's in the message or not. These are, like I said, analysis questions.
Seems well, but we can make a very solid argument that in many programming languages, calling a method is sending a message.
I don't doubt that. But the thing is,
we are going to serialize it on the stack.
Yes. Well, okay, let's just look at C. I'm writing some C code, right? I push a pointer on the stack, push my variables and registers, whatever, call the method. The person receiving that jump, wherever that jump goes to, they don't have to know jack shit. It can be me, and I can know everything. I can know all the things or whatever, but there may be some other programmer who's just getting a jump into his method. And, of course, that creates a mess, and to fix that mess, we pass types. And my point being is once we start passing types in to somebody, we move from messaging to calling functions. And yes, we call it the same thing because messaging without types is painful.
Well, it puts the onus of figuring out what to do based on type somewhere else.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
There's another big difference here in that when we tend to deal with messaging, we tend to deal with weak types, yes. Not strong types.
Yes. Or at least we have that option.
I'm going to send you something. Mm-hmm. When you go to deserialize it, you can deserialize into something that resembles it, but you understand.
You know, I did an essay a week or two ago, and I used the Kinefin model, which is a model of whether you can understand a domain when you look at it or not. And my point was, at the outside of whatever you're doing is chaos. You have no idea. The only requirement there is that your app run. And you don't know what the hell's going on aside from your app running. And to me, that is the boundary, but that would be different depending on what you were doing. So, you know, once you move from chaos in, then you're talking about complex and complicated and simple. When I teach
my advanced class, one of the main things that I really try to hammer home for the students is, so we're working on a document-based model. It's a document that's being passed through multiple services, and each service is dealing with parts of the document that they're interacting with.
Okay.
But they don't understand the entire document.
Yeah.
None of the services, actually, except for the very, very last one, which is the reporting service, understand what the entire document means.
See, yeah, that's just this I'm saying. This is a brilliant idea, because what you're saying and you're demonstrating this is we're confusing whether or not you understand what the document does with what the code does. Two different things. Like, so I can only write code inside of some place where I think I'm actually manipulating stuff. Yay. And so in your example, that's what they're doing. My simple is somebody else's chaos.
The fun thing that we can get into here is that in this document, we can also put the routing inside of the document, couldn't we?
Yeah, you could. You could, but see...
This is known as a saga.
Yeah.
So basically, at the top of the document, I have some URIs. Each one of those URIs is essentially a service who's going to be doing a task. Yes. I set them off at the beginning. I send it to the first one. The first one does his job. He manipulates the document, scratches his name off the list, and then he says, who's the next one? Let me post it over to him.
Yeah, we used to call this document workflow like 20 years ago. That's a big deal. I think SharePoint servers have to do that.
Well, no. The whole point of it is that it's not with something like SharePoint. It's completely decentralized.
No, yeah, I got you. But my point is that once you start drawing out this thing, this amorphous thing that moves around into different places, so different stuff happens to it in some sort of sequence, then that used to be called document workflow, and it was handled in a centralized basis, admittedly. But
correct.
Yeah,
correct. It was handled with a process manager is what most people were doing.
Yeah, but you could do the same thing using, I don't know, Git and GitHub or something. You don't really... The fact that they built an app for it just means that Microsoft wanted to make a lot of money.
Well, there are actually some reasonably difficult things about building out a document passing system like that. One of them is, how do I know the status of everything? Since everything is just being passed from service to service, how do I know where all these documents are and what's going on with them?
Yes.
And there's actually a really interesting way of getting around this, and it's to add a status URI to the document.
Potentially, right.
Right. So as you do things, you tell scenarios.
Every time I'm doing something, I can update the status before I pass off the document.
Yeah.
And then I have a status service, and now we can query the status service for where is this document.
So the important lesson here, I think there's the old joke that every system evolves toward less once it gets mature enough. But I think we really need to understand the fact that if you're writing really good composable things, then at some point you're going to have to work out how you're going to compose them. That might be a computer language, and functionally maybe you're doing a DSL or whatever. But if you're writing real good encapsulated stuff, events or whatever, okay, well, how's the continuation work? How does the sequence work? How's orchestration work? All those other questions, you got to figure that out.
Right.
Well, the main benefit that comes from the having of the URIs in the document when I create the document is think about how versioning works.
Always tell the
difference. Think about if I have five different processes.
Yeah.
When I get the first document, I identify which process is going to go down.
Yes.
You don't need to know about those processes.
Yes. Yeah, so I wrote this composable blocking system a couple years back, and as part of writing your content, you wrote it on a spreadsheet. But the content contained the form you wanted to use to display the content. It was dynamic. So you could say, okay, I want this blog entry to appear on this page or this type of page or whatever. A very similar situation where it's resolved later on. You just put the versioning stuff as part of the data and change it when you need to.
I think what comes to mind is who owns the knowledge of what needs to be done.
Yeah.
Even putting five URIs at the top says you are at least some bit of a god class, and all you're doing is, you know, instead of calling them all yourself, you're shoving something in the document and telling everyone else that has to then know about the next. Well, even though it's just a URI, it's not much knowledge, but still, you know, that's really, that's part of the design.
There are valid circumstances where we actually run into this. Let me just give a concrete example in an organization that you would run into.
Good.
Settling a trade is not something that's going to happen in a financial organization over the next 150 milliseconds. This is a multiple day process. Using this type of pattern allows me to model that in a reasonable way. And there's all sorts of weird, like, edge conditions around settling trades. Some of them might even be like, you need to show up in person with cash and take physical possession of the shares. These actually exist.
So I'm going to try to draw these two threads. I think I understand what you're both saying. John's making the point that if you understand the flow, then you're actually sort of moving up to a higher meta level. You're God class, and you know how it's going to flow, and you're the guy modeling the God class. I think what you're saying, Greg, is more along the lines of, if you have a version composable system, you may not know how the whole thing's going to work, but you know that it's going to work.
Well, and there might be 27 different ways that it works. It's all about those URIs that I drop at the top.
It's very similar to a difference between writing a business application and writing a C compiler. Business application, I have to know everything that's going on and enforce those rules. C compiler, I set up a DSL, and it as long as it runs, we're good. But when you write a C compiler, to my point, you're moving up to that next level. How do you do continuations? How do you do when it crashes? You've got to solve all these language problems that you don't have to solve when you're doing business applications.
The big problem that you have to solve in this particular domain is that, one, you can have multiple asynchronous flows going at the same time. And those asynchronous flows may not all be the same. They may be variations depending on something that we saw about them.
And they may change in process, in situ, as they're moving along.
Correct. Correct. They may change while they're running.
Yeah.
Because some of these things, they might even be running over 90 days. That's actually not that unusual to see, a 90-day process running.
So it's a weird way of thinking about it. If you're used to thinking of like bank transactions and all that, and this gets to the heart of what I was talking about. I made this long comment that nobody cared about, but the point being is that where is the boundary? And the boundary depends on where the programmer's thinking, how he's thinking of solving the problem. If you're having a God class with a preordained set of business rules, then you have a coder looking at everything. If you're thinking about an event stream with a dynamically changing in process, whatever, you're actually making a language, and you're looking at how do these pieces of the language compose together. And that's much harder. It's a lot more flexible, but it's a much harder and different way of looking at things. So I don't think there's an answer to this guy.
Well, but with this particular type of code, what is horrifically nasty about it is because it runs over, let's say, 90 days, what happens when you've changed business rules during those 90 days?
Yes. You change how you're going to settle from being like in person and paper to being whatever, credit cards or REITs. What does that apply to? Does it apply to everything happening today? Or does it apply to things that actually entered the system 2 days ago? There's different answers.
Well, and it becomes a really, really nasty problem that you will find in almost every financial institution.
Yeah,
but I'm going to say, just my little knowledge from the insurance world, you can't just change shit and then not honor, something that's grandfathered. Right. So what I've experienced is, you can have a new way to sell and apply for an insurance policy starting in June 1st, but it doesn't mean the one that you submitted on May 31st is version one.
Right.
That might be version two, but you can't. Yeah, so I would just assume there's some business logic that said, you got to maintain the path that this thing went down. You can't, probably.
So I think the difference here, John, is that when you buy an insurance policy, that's not only behavior you want from the system, that's a legal behavior between you and the company. And so
correct.
But when you perhaps purchase some stock, you're just agreeing with the stock company that they're going to follow normal procedures to do whatever, and what that means may be really confusing. It may not be a single behavior.
Hey, it will work 999 times out of 1,000. The question is that one where it doesn't work. And the person on the other side goes, I know I sold that to you, but I don't actually have it. And, you sold it to RBC, and RBC sold it to... And now we've got this entire chain.
Right.
And you try to use futzing and statistical data processing, you try.
Well, the fun thing with this particular problem is you can literally end up with $500 billion companies involved with this problem.
Yeah.
Is that $500 billion companies or
in number of $500 billion companies?
Yeah.
Fair question. Minutes. In a single day, these shares might have been in 10 organizations.
Yeah. To my point,
let me rephrase. They might have been on paper in 10 organizations.
See, this is a really cool question because you're asking the difference between, am I modeling the business itself, or am I creating a system for the business to model itself as it goes along? There are two different goals.
Yeah, depending largely on the business requirements.
Depending on the business requirements, yep. So the next article is Ideas on Mute. There was a Nature, a study published in Nature that said that remote meetings are worse at doing brainstorming, but they're better at evaluating ideas. I thought that was really interesting.
Seems legitimate.
Yeah, you know, I was noticing that when I work with creative teams, a lot of times we just do random bullshit. Maybe we're drawing a whiteboard or get some Play-Doh out or, you know, just go out to eat. It's nothing you can plan. And one of the things it says that the researchers found that staring turned out to be a major inhibitor of creative activity, because when you're on a video, you feel as if you should stare into the camera, but when you're doing that, you're not actually being creative.
Huh. A lot of times when you know, John Turley, you've met my one colleague. Yeah, we're often, well, I'm usually walking, but I'm often staring at the ceiling. I can imagine that if you are locked in, it probably is a different response, because I feel like we can hit a very creative mode on Zoom, but we're not staring at each other. To your point, that's interesting.
One of my most important, most interesting creative relationships, I was working with a program manager, and we just go for walks for lunch. It turned out to just kind of walking around town generated a lot of solutions.
Yep.
We used to do that as well, and it actually turned out quite reasonably. But the reason we were doing it was because to even walk to lunch was like a half-mile walk.
Okay. You're away from town, I guess.
No. We were on a military base.
Oh, dang. Which
service? Well, calling it a military base is a bit too much. It's a military base / research facility /
complex.
I'll tell you this much: there were army guys that you had to cross in order to get into the area.
So before I started,
once you were on it, you couldn't really go anywhere.
So before I started consulting, we had one of these Christmas and April deals where you go and fix up houses. And I went downtown on the Saturday and helped some people fix up a house. And I'm talking to this guy next to him. He's like, yeah, he said, I was in the intelligence service for a while. I said, cool. He had like a doctorate from MIT in computer science. I'm like, whoa, I'm a programmer too, dude. And he said he worked for the Navy. He was like a lieutenant colonel, had never wore a uniform. Yep. So he said the admiral called him one day and said, you guys got to put your uniform in. Nobody had any uniforms. He said it was so strange. We would show up at the gate, and it would just be like a little building here. And the guy would just, he would recognize us, would give us ID or whatever. He said, but if you look inside the building, you're like grenade launchers and all kinds of shit there.
Yep.
I just thought that was the coolest job.
The hilarious thing about when you're going through those checkpoints is that probably 80%, 90% of the people that go through those checkpoints are military members. Huh. And then there are the researchers who are going through those checkpoints. It's like, I've been working here for 9 years. I still have no idea what this process should actually be.
Oh, yeah, I was working, doing some DOD stuff, and after 9/11, they got the mirrors and the dogs go around your car and all that. It escalated quite a bit.
Well, but the thing is, they tell all of the military members, like, this is what you should expect, this is how you should behave, this is what you should... The military's very, very good at that.
Sure.
With all the contractors, they're like, yeah, screw you.
Trust me, they'll tell you where you need to go, okay? They're pretty good at that.
Yeah, actually, I think the craziest day I ever went there was on 9/11.
Oh, wow.
What do you think happened to security that day?
Got really tight.
Yeah, I imagine you started seeing some guns.
Guns? They were like APCs and tanks out front. It's like, I was driving up my little RX-7, I think it was at the time, and it's like, what the hell just happened?
Oh, yeah. All right, so in the 80s, I was a Marine. Of course, I guess I still am a Marine. But before I got out, We were doing hostage rescue operations, and they're like, hey, Markham, you get to be the ambassador because you're half-assed civilian anyway. So put your jeans on. I'm like, okay, fine. So they locked me up. They put me in this little building, and I was in the attic, and they went out and did their daily prayers, and it was a whole thing as if they were terrorists, and I was an ambassador. Well, what I learned was when they come rescue you, it is not a pleasant experience. If you're the hostage, you're a big sack of meat. They're going to move around where they want you. So, I mean, if shit goes down, buddy, they will put you where you need to go. Trust me on that one.
That makes sense.
Hey, yeah. The goal is to get you out. It's not to pet you along the way.
Yeah, they don't like you to check your ID. And they do search you because it turns out that some terrorists will sometimes mix in their guys with the hostages so they can send them out with the rescue team. So you will get searched, and you will get body slammed and all that, but you'll come out okay, I guess.
You'll come out not mostly hurt.
It was one of the more fun things I did in the service. I got to be the ambassador, and they flew me out to the ship after they rescued me, and then they did like cops and robbers where they went through the ship with the guns because it was fun stuff. I really enjoyed, you know, blowing things up and learning how to kill people. It just wasn't a lot of money, and it didn't look good on the resume later on.
Ah, it depends who you're sending your resume to.
Yeah, so those COBOL C basic grenade launchers, C4,
M14,
yes, yeah. Corba, Com Plus. Okay, so this next story, I'm trying to do some more kind of slice of life programmer stuff because one of our watchers on Twitter is like, you know, guys, try to do more like, here I am programming every day and here's the problem I have. I thought it was a great idea, as long as we didn't get into trashing random people, because it is sort of, most of the time people will just complain online. This guy said, hey, this lady said, where's the conversation at? She was like, I get this as a user, want to blah, 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 but then what happens? And people said, hey, it's a conversation. So then she went, okay, well, where's that at? And I was like, well, and here was it. Where does this conversation actually happen? And so this is the old, you guys are keeping secrets from us, aren't you, sort of thing. I used to get that all the time. It's like, dude, what's your acceptance test? If you know what your acceptance test is, you're done with the conversation. If you don't, you got to find out. That's the conversation. And that blew a lot of people's minds because they were thinking Three Amigos and backlog refinement and gyro tickets. I got all kinds of crazy shit. One guy said, you know, TDD and coding doesn't go together. So I was just, it's weird.
Wait. TDD and coding doesn't go together. How would you do TDD without coding?
I have no idea.
Like, there's, I'm wondering what this is. This must be for some definitions of TDD.
Yeah, task-driven.
Yeah, and one guy said, yeah, we just do a bunch of JIRA tickets, and they're all, in my words, they're just to-do items. And I'm like, hey, that's fine if you want to keep a big list of to-do items. I don't care. But to answer her question, you have conversations until you know what the acceptance test is. Even if you want to keep to-do items, it's the same answer. You don't code until you know how you know you're going to be done successfully. It's
right. When is it pencil down time?
Yeah.
No. There's a bit of an exception to this. The bit of an exception to this would be when I'm working on a spike.
Very interesting. At that point, you're an MVP in a startup role. It's when you're coding to learn.
We're going to spike this to see, like, what we need to learn.
Yes, right.
Yeah, but that's still, I'll time box it, and we have some semblance of what we're after, right? So one
well,
really...
Yeah, great. But we don't but we don't constrict things to the point of, I need a user story for that. A lot of it's exploratory.
Yeah, I did a similar thing a couple months back. I've set up an RTMP server on AWS, and I'd never done one before, so really the first couple hours I did videos. First couple hours is, let's find out about RTMP servers and what is the easiest way we can set one up. And it turned out it was just a spike, what it turned out to be, but it was like, okay, here's the server, here's our options, here's the simplest way. It was needed, but the acceptance criteria was, I know the different options for setting this kind of server up.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't have acceptance criteria, dude, you're consulting. You're not coding. No requirements.
Well, but acceptance criteria for consulting would be that I gave you new things.
I just made you reconsider stuff you thought was stupid because it wasn't really stupid. But you didn't know. Yeah, that's
I gave you something completely different.
Yeah, which turned out to be the same as something else, but had a new brand name on it. I'm just fucking curious. I think the trick maybe is that you give them something they perceive as being new, but because it sounds new to them, they can accept it. Whereas the same thing with a different name, like a year ago, that they threw out, it's like, oh, that's the other thing. We don't do that.
It can happen like that.
Oh, I had a guy.
To be honest, that's the biggest thing that you run into in consulting is there is this giant problem, and there is a very simple solution that solves 98% of the cases. And for some bizarre reason, that solution has been thrown out for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
And then they have continued working upon those last 2% of cases.
I continue to find, and I'm not the best at this, but I keep running into this. We know how to do it. We know better than what we're doing currently. But there's some little people thing, like somebody pissed off some other guy a year ago. There's all this kind of backstory that has nothing to do with the technology itself. And so then you're kind of stuck going, okay, guys, this is your answer. What the fuck's wrong with you? Or, okay, we need to get in the room and, like, tell stories to each other. Either way, it doesn't feel like a productive environment, really.
Yeah, there's so much weirdness in so many organizations.
I decided that consulting was just being a paid friend. You know, somebody who can hear what's going on, has been around the block a few times, can offer good ideas, try to help you accept things you couldn't accept, but the way you're being judged is, are you a good friend? Are you able to improve my life without, you know, pissing me off or whatever?
Yeah, I kind of look at it as trying to help the organization and the teams change the patterns of their conversations and be, you know, that's a goofy way to say. There's a lot more under it, not just technical things to do, but really how to go about how we do things so that we can be more humble and curious and try to tackle stuff.
Yes.
Long after we leave.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we're saying the same thing. You probably did a better job. If you're out digging a hole, you know, like somebody who doesn't know you doesn't care, but somebody who's a friend will come out and say, why are you digging a hole? And they'll have a conversation. Hopefully, you know, you'll be validated or you'll stop digging the hole. Either way, that's a friend. That's somebody who's caring about what you're doing and helping you sort of evaluate from the outside what it looks like.
Right.
Okay, so next story is this startup creates a simulator for info warfare operations. And this blew my mind because they're doing a simulator for like Facebook, Twitter. You're like a battalion intelligence agent. You're in Ukraine or whatever, and you want to know what's going on social media. So these people will create a simulated social media environment during your war invasion or whatever, and you get to sort of farm it to figure out from the citizens exactly what's going on.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. All right, so this next one is another mRNA story. So I've been following COVID for some time, and as part of that, I got really excited about Moderna and the mRNA virus stuff they're doing. And I said, guys, watch this, because there's going to be some awesome shit coming down the pike. And this mRNA breakthrough offers a potential heart attack cure. They're thinking about using this to heal your heart. And the way this works is mRNA actually programs your cells to release proteins that then do things to your body. That's the gimmick. And so you actually make your body into a factory that tells itself to do new things, and that's only limited by what you can program the mRNA to do. And so they can do cancer. It's not just viruses. There's all kinds of other stuff in it. Right now, it's just pigs, though.
It's okay. Pigs on a wings next.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we should have been mice because they've, like, solved every problem for mice. The mice that
they have very special mice that they produce for certain bioengineering. Yeah.
Yeah, the mice, they're super strong. You lose weight. They live forever. It's like, damn.
What's kind of funny with the mRNA stuff is when we look at it today, we need to understand that we are back in the 1930s and 1940s for things like radio and television.
Yes.
There's going to be a huge amount of progression that occurs.
So as I understand it, I'm a novice, but we used to think that the DNA was like the program that ran everything. You just make a new program. Well, that turned out to be way too simplistic. Proteins do everything in the body. DNA makes proteins. This mRNA stuff can actually make proteins. So the new thing is proteomics, is what they call it. And the idea is to build proteins that do specific things. And you can use the DNA system to do that. It's like a double win. And that's a whole level of indirection that we never thought was there.
This is I was going to say, it's probably why the inventor of the mRNA said, yeah, this whole, what we're using it for with COVID, it's not exactly what we intended it for.
Yeah, it's the COVID stuff may be 1% of what it turns out to be useful for. Anything where you can do protein modeling.
Right, because it did the spike protein. It messed around with the little grippy thing at the end of the spike protein. On the coronavirus.
What's going to be very interesting, though, is what's going to happen with this on both sides. So let's just imagine that you are a conspiracy theorist and you actually believe that coronavirus was engineered in a lab and blah, 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 blah. This technology is equally as useful for doing that.
Yes. Yeah, we have this problem with scientific stuff not being reproducible. I read an article the other day. It was like, yeah, but we can't make it reproducible because then people can do evil things with it. And they're not wrong.
Some things.
I mean, we're kind of at the point where, you know, you could probably get a degree in molecular biology and do all kinds of really evil stuff. I don't know how you wind that clock back the other way. I think we're there.
Well, it's similar to trying to agree on what kind of warfare is okay and what kind's not. Yeah, so it's, you know, gain of function research, not okay here. Okay, we'll move it over to Wuhan.
Yes.
You know, certain kinds of chemical warfare is not okay here. All right, well, some other rogue nations might still engage in it.
Yeah, sometimes I talk to people.
It's still going to happen.
I talk to people and say, look, we shouldn't engineer our DNA to be super strong. And their answer to me is, well, if we don't, somebody else will.
Fair response.
Yeah. It's a game theory situation where, you know, once the technology's out there, everybody has to use it.
Well, you don't have to use it. You can be destroyed instead.
We're kind of entering a world where everybody's going to have their own nuclear weapon delivery system. It might not be nukes, but it'll be a similar situation. That's why we need to move out of the neighborhood. We need to find, like, a better place, like Mars or Titan or something.
They'll still follow you.
Yeah, you know, wherever you go. It's like the neighbors move in, and then it's a big kerfuffle, and the cops show up,
What it reminds me a lot of is back in the old BBS days of dealing with viruses. So, like, you would get pissed off with another BBS, and so you'd write a virus and infect their BBS with the virus and all their users, but then they'd come back and they'd infect your BBS.
I must have missed that. I was just a poor schlub on CompuServe. I don't remember.
Oh, come on, we know you didn't use CompuServe. You were on AOL.
Yeah, no.
I was on Delphi, the first commercial people got, and I remember going to Usenet, and like I guess 84 or something. I go to Usenet, and there's already I drop into a flame war for having some kind of argument. Like, wow, this isn't very useful. And I went on and did something else.
That's funny.
Next article is the 10 most shameful role playing game device dices, and here's the D100. Which has so many little facets, it's like a ball, and it just keeps rolling. The guy said, you don't have to roll in the box, because it just rolls away. And good luck figuring out which number it actually came out. he's got the alignment dice that tells you whether you're chaotic, lawful, or whatever. He's like, if you need help figuring out what your personality is going to be, role-playing might not be for you.
Yeah, that ought to help.
That crystal dice... It's like, what?
I do like the D, too. The penny. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah, the D2, yeah. So, yeah, the D1000, where you can like a roll of number. He's like, if you do like your stuff in thousands, you're getting statistical analysis. You're not playing a game anymore. I guess you can get gold, solid gold dye. That's a lot of money there. And they make, God help them, they make a D5, which my brain does not compute.
How do you have five-sided dice?
I don't know. Yeah, he said it's supposed to work. Yeah, it's evil. Is it D34?
Yeah, that looks a lot like the dreidel.
Yeah. It's a dreidel, yeah. And there's actually a dice you can get that's made out of ground-up dinosaur bones, which sounds really kind of bad.
It's funny, it's out of stock.
For a long time. So this next part, I think the D thing was the funny one I picked for this week. Scott Ambler sent in this one. Scott Ambler sent in, this is how dark matter and regular matter talk to each other, claims Wild New Paper. And Scott was laughing, I know, at the headline, but basically it's just a new way of thinking about dark matter and gravity.
Oh, yeah. I guess those may be bear claws. Oh, you're back.
I'm back.
Right. Of course, you were always there.
What was
speaking of being on the boundary of systems.
You know, Greg and I, Greg James and I, we had a three-way last week, and we didn't have I don't think we had one hitch the whole time, and we've had three hitches, so who knows? It's the internet.
Maybe you should track it. Sunspots or something.
Hey, it's James. I guess he's dropping by to listen. Hey, James, hope you're having a good week. He's on his mobile line. So this is how dark matter and regular matter talk to each other.
I am. You probably can't understand me because we've got really bad internet.
We can't understand you because I have really bad reception.
You guys have fun. I'm saying hi.
Hey, James. Good to see you, man, my friend. You on the beach
Hello,
again?
James.
Are you hanging out on the beach?
Today's a sea day. We're at sea.
Dang. Story of my life. I've been at sea for many years.
I can't stay. I just wanted to say hi.
Good to see you. All right. Thanks for coming by.
See you next week. See you next week. Hi, John. Hi, Greg.
Have fun.
Enjoy.
Okay, I'll try.
Oh, yeah. Bye. Suffer. Poor guy. Poor James. Yeah.
And Daniel, I think it's now time we should all sing In the Navy.
In the Navy.
Okay. What? I'll wait around for that.
No, we don't do the sing-along. They told us, Discord guy said, no more sing-along. This place got some class to it.
Oh, no, see, that's okay. Okay, have fun. I've got to go to the our party now. Okay. So it's party time. Bye.
Bye. All right. See you, James.
You know, Greg, I don't think that guy was a real policeman. Okay? And in the Navy, fact, folks, so I think that maybe they weren't actually the firefighter, the Indian. I don't think they were real. I don't think it was a real Indian. I know that guy wasn't an Indian. There's something else going on there, okay?
I'm unsure. We might need to research it more.
So I worked in San Francisco for a while, and my 18-year-old came out at the time to visit me, and I went to work, and I said, just walk around, have fun, do whatever you want to. He ends up in the Tenderloin District.
Oh, boy.
Like, oh, shit, boy. Kid.
What's that, dare I ask? Is it like the red light district?
It's weird for San Francisco.
Like, it would be like ending up in the Marigny in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's San Francisco is weird to begin with. This is the San Francisco of San Francisco. He didn't come out for another 2 years. I should have figured it out at that point, but it took another 2 years for the gears to all click through. He was a good kid. I'm glad he didn't get...
It's the kind of place where things that would be normally 1 to 2 standard deviations outside of normal would be Thursday night.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, it's San Francisco has grown into a cesspool since then, but I mean, 20, 30 years back, it was just a really weird place. Really
yeah.
weird.
Like which is okay. Like a joyfully, there's some funny things and some weirdness and yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, the thing that the trannies would do, the parade. I mean, they had fun. There was a feeling of joyful weirdness.
I remember eating at a place that had this long running. Why is the name of the southern French food dish? Not Carcassonne.
Cajon?
No. But it's like a stew with
chili con carne.
No, it's a French dish. Gosh, I need to go slap my head around. But anyway, Willie Mayer Brown came in.
Oh wow!
To the restaurant. Yeah. So it was like, it was cool, just with some other person. But yeah, he's a cool dude. Hey, it's the mayor. Yeah. It was neat. I think it was the Metropolitan. Really cool bar. Yeah.
I was in D.C., I guess, first or second time I worked there, and I went to eat at a Ruth's Chris Steakhouse because I had to go. And I'm sitting there, I realized that Jim Lehrer is sitting behind me. He's the guy who had the PBS News Hour with Jim Lehrer. And I was, another story, I was in Santa Paula, California. I learned to fly aerobatics. John McCain comes in. Like, whoa, dude. Very cool.
It's always fun when you start bumping into very, very famous people in completely unusual circumstances.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing. Like, if you go to, like, the gala being run by the embassy and you were to bump into the president, it's like, okay, this is kind of normal. But when you bump into the president in a coffee shop.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I think Santa Barbara is probably a good place for this, but there's a lot of people that have this public persona of being like super rich and you can't get to them, blah, blah, blah. And they're down at the A&P supermarket buying like chicken and stuff. It's just they don't go to the one next to you. So they go to one Santa Barbara or whatever.
Yeah, SLA was what I was thinking of.
Ah.
And I think it was in Les Centrales.
Ooh.
That was where it was. They had like a sign on the mirror that said, 964 days of something crazy like that. Uh-huh. I think they just keep adding to it. You just keep adding to the pot.
What's more funny is when you bump into them and you don't know who they are.
Yeah, I make it a point. I've never done the can I have your autograph ever. I'm just not a celebrity guy. But it's still kind of weird when you're doing some kind of mundane thing and you recognize a person you normally would never recognize. Like, oh, wait a minute, that's freaking John McCain. Hey, wait a minute, I saw this guy on TV.
Well, no, yeah. it's even more funny when you have no idea who the hell they are, yeah. But they expect you to.
Oh my God.
And like, they're playing subtle, like, oh, yeah, you know who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, no, I have no fucking clue who you are.
You should
were in Morocco this past fall, and in this the hotel where we were staying, and John Malkovich and his partner, because they've been together for like 30 years, but after his first divorce, he never married. So, you know, not his wife, but might as well be. And I opened up this sliding glass door for him to come walking from like the patio into the restaurant. She said, he didn't say anything. He just walked through, but she said, thank you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well,
I did take a paparazzi picture of him, so I do have that. Oh. I didn't share it with anybody, but so I'm sure they were just there chilling out like we were.
Well, he did that, I don't know if you've seen that movie, Being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks just like he does in the movies. It's pretty recognizable.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Melissa and I have gotten better. One of the games we play when we watch TV, because we have no lives, is when we see an actor, we try to guess their name, and then we go to IMDb to figure out who it is. And so we've gotten pretty good at, you know, like third-grade actors, we can guess a lot of bit part people. But so, there are some people that look the same. It's like, dude, you look the same.
Yeah. Here's a weird thing again. It's probably just my brain's falling apart. But the scent of a woman came up. I think Sue was doing a crossword puzzle. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's like that really funny, you know, like Al Pacino or whatever. He's blind. And all I remember was a really funny scene where he's like driving a Ferrari. And the guy sitting next to him is telling him, you know, when to turn and when to turn. And in my mind, the guy next to him was Tom Cruise. Oh. And the woman that he dances with was Julia Roberts. Totally wrong. but I because she's like, no, I don't think so. So I went to IMDb. Oh, the young kid looked like he could have been sort of Tom Cruise-ish. And the woman looked like she could have been Julia, you know, but in my mind, I would have lost money.
And I've seen movies where, I swear to goodness, they hired the actors they hired because they looked like the other people.
That could be.
Yeah, it's like, oh, he looks kind of like Tom Cruise. We'll put him in, people won't know.
Yeah.
Well, there's a very good example of movies where they hired people because they looked like other people in the movies. Lord of the Rings. Can you imagine if all the elves were randomly hired?
Yeah, true. Elves had to be the same. Yeah, sure enough. So the last article here was sent by Greg, and Greg wins the internet for the week with this one. It's discrete mathematics with ducks.
That's pretty funny.
And it's a book, and it's got ducks. So, hell, what's there not to like?
It actually exists.
You can get it used for $30 or new for $105.
Yeah, I'd go for the new one.
Yeah, them ducks, they're fooling around. You're not going to get a duck to write a book for less than $100. Tell you that.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I was tempted, but I don't know, $25. I don't know. It's actually, there's
oh,
a
you
new,
know you want it.
There's
well, it's
new,
got good... Good review ratings.
Yeah, it did get good reviews. It's a newer book.
Six friends of the author, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's also a student handbook for discrete mathematics with ducks. Which, you got to get the handbook. The number of college, you get the book, then you get the book to tell you what the book means.
You got to bundle it, yeah, for sure.
That's where my calculus book was. I got the calculus book. Then I got the book to tell me what the calculus book was telling me.
Yeah, I always learned just to find the other one. The one with solutions to problems in the book.
That's all I need, right?
Yeah. You know, my calculus teacher was a hoot. My calculus teacher, he would do things on the board, and it would look simple, and then I would, like, walk out of the room. And by the time I got down the hall, I was like, what the hell did he just do? And I learned it, but I pretty much just had to go through the book and learn it.
Yeah, I had a funny calculus teacher in high school, Richard Gogler. He was good. Yeah. He turned me on to a couple of a couple of funny books. So, you know, one was Pi, written out to the millionth decimal place, done by the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, and done on calculators. There was a picture in there of a room full of people, I think mostly women, with the hand, you know, doing calculations. Wow. And so all the book was pages full of numbers, taking it out. And then the other book he gave me was a fascinating one. I think I bought a used one. So maybe I need to say this for the next Nerd Roundup, but it was called A Day in the Life of T.C. Mitz or something like that. So, yeah, I'll have to post that link.
So I guess before we go, we should do, like, to John's point, what have you guys been, John, what have you been reading or watching TV, anything cool, movies or anything?
Well, reading a funny book that the school superintendent have to give me. It's called like Catalyst or something like that. And it's the basic subtitle is how to change anyone's mind or something like that. Of course, my wife sees it. She goes, don't try that on me.
Yeah.
Don't be doing none of that around here. It's interesting because it talks about all kinds of different biases, you know, confirmation bias and, you know, opposing views. So it's kind of a fascinating take on, you know, how people think and how, even if you're trying to change something for the better, it's not, you know, status quo and all kinds of things raise their ugly head. So it's kind of cool. It's what I'm reading.
I'm going to say this while I could think of it. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Greg, but so on the audiobook format, I'm finishing Lord of the Rings, and I'm starting E-Day, which is a space opera. Fun junk food on the e-books, audiobooks. Then on the hardback books, I've started into How We Learn, which is a neuroscientist talking about comparing artificial intelligence with what we know about how brains actually work. And I've just got to the part where they take apart baby's brains. That's all who's not for that? That's fun times. Well, I mean, he doesn't actually dissect them. He just talks about how babies go from nothing to language and stuff like that. So it's fascinating. It was a little dry, but I'm slugging through it. How about you, Greg? Any movies, TV shows, anything good?
Most of my TV interactions have been with things that are quite old.
Huh.
The one thing I did kind of look at a little bit was Moon Knight.
Oh, this is the superhero thing, right?
Yeah.
That was the show that Melissa and I never could figure out what was going on, but the guy couldn't figure out either, so we felt like we were kind of even with the hero because nobody knew what the hell was happening.
Yeah, so I'm just getting into it.
The hero, I guess, put nicely, has multiple personality disorder, and so he wakes up in weird places, and we're supposed to figure out what happened while he was asleep and who he was, and it becomes rather hard to sort of dissemble and figure out what's going on.
It sounds kind of similar to being lost in Lost.
You mean the TV show Lost?
Yes.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Lost. I didn't think I would, but my family actually made me watch it. They're like, you're going to sit down and watch it.
No.
And it was good. I really enjoyed watching.
That was a really long-running series, yes. Right? With some island or something?
That is correct. And J.J. Abrams, this is actually when he could do good stuff. It was just a sort of a X-Files mystery thing, but they drew it all to a close. So somehow or another, when it finished, there was a complete story.
Oh, I did like X-Files. That was cool.
Yeah, the biggest part I didn't like about X-Files is it never felt like you were ever going to get to the end.
True.
Well, that was pretty much the same thing with Lost.
No, they finished it up. I mean, there were a couple threads. I want to know about what the hell a Dharma shark was, but I mean.
Come on! No, the only reason they finished it up is because they're going to be taken off the air.
Yeah, but my point being is somehow
they could have run that for another 7 seasons.
I don't know how they managed to tie together the threads they did, Greg. But I can probably give you 40 different little threads that went throughout the whole show that somehow came to a resolution. And that's unusual.
Well, that's probably you had the advantage because I'm going to guess you sort of binge watched it.
Well, yeah, I did because I was instructed to do it, but the family had to watch it week by week. And as I understand, when they did it week by week, it was an internet thing. So they would do a show, people would wonder on the internet what they were doing, and then the writers would read what the people were saying. So it was, they got this kind of feedback loop going where the fans actually made it more interesting.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah, I think in the season one, just I won't give a spoiler away, but the last show, this guy finds a hatch on the island, and he gets in, and he has to push in numbers on a computer every 38 minutes. And you're not told why they're these numbers or why it's every 38 minutes. But he's told if he doesn't do this, the whole place will blow up. You're not told, is it really going to blow up? And so you're like, and you know they just pulled this out of their ass. They had to have pulled this out of their ass. But then these same numbers appear through the next 6 years. And so at some point, the numbers make sense. And they tell you, here's why they got the numbers. And it's like, but yeah. So it's a real head scratcher. All right, let me do my goodbye thing. Well, there you go. You've lost another hour and 50 minutes or so. Really happy you came by today. I'm Daniel Markham. I'm at danielbmarkham.com. This had been Nerd Roundup. I will see you on the internet. Okay, guys, I thought that went pretty well.
Yeah.
Any complaints? Anything to do better next time?
Nah.
I really like the, like I said, we had a guy on Twitter say, do more slice of life stuff because I think he said the young kids will like it. But his point being, when you talk about an article where somebody says they're struggling, it's something that's more immediately relatable to people. And I really help programs.
Does he mean life or life as a programmer? Or
yeah, the daily struggle, like filling out a Java ticket or trying to get something installed in an environment or this one guy. You know, the stuff where I'm a programmer and I'm struggling, I think it's a great idea, but I looked at doing it, and I'm like, wait a minute, this could easily devolve into, well, you're a big dummy, you didn't know how to do that. And it's like, I don't be that guy.
Okay. So in other words, if we run across a topic that or even a tweet like you were showing, something that might lend itself to, oh, here's a good example. A lot of people run into this sort of thing. Let's chat about it.
Yeah, like the when does conversations occur, right?
Yeah.
Or even like a mono repo versus branching.
You need to schedule them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the whole idea. Like, look, you want to go down that factory model, that's fine, but it's a bad end. You're not going to be happy.
Yeah.
Okay,
guys. How'd you get the duck up there?
I know. It rose up. It was kind of cool.
Hey, he comes up. Watch. Watch this.
Yeah, watch. There it comes.
Oh!
Yeah, that's some high-tech stuff, buddy.
It is.
And so at the end, when I do goodbye, I have a book that swings around you. It doesn't always work, but it's like a picture of my book that comes around. I burn out my Alienware laptop doing that.